brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you? Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Chuck Bryant.
Liar.
You could tell. There's ways you can find out, Chuck.
Sure.
We'll get to that in a minute. This is Stuff You Should Know. Let me finish.
Okay.
And it's You Lie. Remember that guy?
Oh, yeah.
Joey Pants or whatever the congressman's name was?
Yeah, Saturday Night Live Joe had a funny skit that he had gotten a whole group of people to all stand up at once. Wasn't that the deal?
Yeah, tell it.
And, well, yeah, and he supposedly had a whole group of senators that were going to all stand up and yell, "You lie."
Mm-hmm.
And then he was the only one that did it.
Yeah.
That's
because he was out of the room when they were like, "No, we can't do that."
Yeah, I think that was it. That was funny.
Yeah. So, we're talking about lie detectors, but let me take you back.
All right.
To a little place in time and space called the Jazz Age, early 1920s. Yeah? No, that's the Beatniks that did that.
Oh, okay. I'm sure a jazz person snapped their fingers at one point.
Sure.
Okay.
But not like that.
All right.
It was more like...
like Coltrane style?
Just like that.
Gotcha.
Anyway, this is 1921, Chuck, in Berkeley, California, at UCLA Berkeley. And there is a place there called the College Hall, which is a women's dorm. And in that year... There was a string of thefts, cash, rings, pretty much anything of value went missing for a little while there. And there is a man working at the Berkeley Police Department.
This is in the girls' dorm?
Yeah.
Okay.
Called College Hall.
Gotcha.
There was a man working in the Berkeley Police Department. His name is John Larson. And John Larson was the first cop ever to have a PhD. And he had gotten interested in this device called a cardiopneumopsychograph, which had been invented just a few years before by another guy named William Marston. And William Marston was a lawyer and a Harvard shrink. And he also, as an aside, created Wonder Woman with her lasso of truth.
Really?
He's the guy who invented what's now called the polygraph.
But yeah. What about the Wonder Woman? He created Wonder Woman,
yeah.
The character?
Yes. He was kind of a Renaissance man. But that's William Marston. John Larson works at the Berkeley Police Department, and he's become interested in this thing, the cardiopneumopsychograph.
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes, okay, this is a perfect chance to apply it. So he rounds up, you know, some suspects. He does some normal police work and finds out who the suspects are in this hall.
Right.
And he rounds them up, brings them down to the station, and he starts hooking people up to this machine. And he gets to this one woman. Her name is Helen Graham. And
guilty.
Yes, pretty much is what he does. He goes, "Ms. Graham, this machine is saying that you took the money. You know, did you?" And he said that he noted on the machine a sharp drop in blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
followed by a sudden rise. And then after that, this woman flew into a rage. She tried to attack the machine.
Really?
She went crazy. So they basically string her along for a few days, and then finally she confesses. And it's the first time that a polygraph was ever used to solve a crime, ever.
That was probably the heyday, because before the people knew what it was, they could just say, "This machine says that you're guilty," and they would be like, "Oh, my God, how does it know?"
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Very early on, some of the early proponents, specifically a guy named Leonard Keeler, recognized the placebo effect value before anyone knew there was a placebo effect, but the placebo effect value of a polygraph.
Yeah.
That just the idea, if you believed in this machine,
mm-hmm.
and that it could root out lies, then it could force you to confess just being hooked up to it.
Right.
You weren't going to pass it.
They should have called it the guilt box.
They called it the magic lie detector is one of the
really?
Things that they called it. Yeah, Leonard Keeler called it that. He worked with John Larson at the Berkeley Police Department, and eventually over time, John Larson saw what he considered the truth behind the lie detector and the fact that it kept being called lie detector, which was driving him crazy.
Yeah, sure.
And he eventually distanced himself from it later on in his career. But Leonard Keeler ran around marketing it to anyone and everyone, saying, "Just having this."
Right.
is going to not only help you hire more truthful, forthright people, but it's going to keep them in line while they're working for you because they know you've got access to this thing and you can strap them to it at any time.
Wow.
Yep. So that's where the polygraph came from.
Yeah, there's a little prehistory, too, just to give them their due.
Yeah.
In 1895, Cesare Lombroso, he's an Italian criminologist. He measured changes in blood pressure for police cases.
Okay.
And in 1904, a device by Vittorio Benussi measured breathing. And so they were early 1900s, late 1800s, they were kind of on the scene of measuring these things. And Dr. James McKenzie, in 1906, first mentioned the word polygraph with his instrument that he didn't use to root out the truth, but for he did use it when giving medical examinations, though.
And then right before the polygraph was the unigraph.
Unigraph?
Which was part of what's still used today in the polygraph. It measured respiration.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. But then you add to it a couple of other things, and you got the polygraph.
We could stop here. This is interesting enough right now.
So there's no... really?
No.
There's no no one walking the planet who has anything to do with polygraphs that call them lie detectors. And anyone, even the most ardent defender of polygraph technology, would correct you if you called it a lie detector. They would be like, it's not a lie detector.
Because you can't detect a lie. It's impossible.
The whole basis of a polygraph is that it is a set of medical instruments that you use to measure changes in things like your heart rate, your respiration, and sweatiness, basically.
Yeah, I would fail.
Well, a lot of people do fail, and we'll get to that. But, because of your sweat?
Oh, yeah.
That's okay.
They wouldn't even hook me up. They'd just be like, dude.
You look so good.
Yeah, you're so sweaty right now.
So when you're hooked up to this machine, the whole point is that it measures these physiological changes, and the idea that you're going to undergo a physiological change is based on the concept that a person hooked to this machine who is guilty will experience fear that they're going to be detected.
Right.
So this machine is designed to detect that fear.
That's right.
Which is really roundabout. But for a century almost.
Yeah.
These things were used and abused, and it took a while for people to kind of catch on that there's a lot to criticize here with polygraphs.
Yeah, for sure, but they're still used. All right, so let's get into this. First of all, we need to point out that analog polygraphs are what you have long seen in movies and TV when they have the little jittery, looks like a seismograph on the on the paper scrolling by, and you're hooked up to all these different things on your chest and your forehead and your fingertips.
Yep.
These days, they do that digitally, but it's basically still the same technique.
Yeah.
They just don't use the little scrolling needle. Do they have a name for that? I'm sure
they do. It's called an ink-filled pen.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. But the three things that they do, Josh, they measure your respiratory rate, as you said. They take pneumographs, which are rubber tubes filled with air, time around your chest and your abdomen, and that is going to measure whether or not you start breathing heavy, essentially, when you get nervous.
It monitors your breathing pattern and any changes to it, and it does it pretty cleverly, right?
Yeah, with bellows. They're filled with air, so when you breathe in real deeply or have a change, it's going to displace that into the bellows, and that will, originally that was attached, the bellows were literally attached to the mechanical arm.
Right.
That showed the change. These days it's a transducer that converts it digitally, electronically.
Right. It converts it to an electrical pattern, right?
Yeah, that probably just says
why. But it's virtually the same thing.
Yeah.
No, I think it looks a lot like it. If you look, there's a picture of a modern one, and the graph.
It's the same thing.
It looks just like it, but yeah, it's not a paper readout any longer.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting. Like, this technology hasn't changed on a very fundamental basis for like 100 years almost.
Yeah, I mean, the early one from McKenzie in 1906, they say that a lot of the same components are still very similar today.
Right. You also are going to have, so you're going to have two tubes, one around your chest, one around your abdomen. That's keeping an eye on your breathing.
Yes.
You're going to have a blood pressure cuff, which keeps an eye on your heart rate and your blood pressure. And it does it through sound, right?
Yeah, I didn't realize this.
So when the blood comes in and out of your veins, it creates sound, and sound can also be used to displace air, causing a bellows to contract,
mm-hmm.
which, again, moved the arm on the scroll and now is created or turned into an electrical pattern.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing. But it's sound, which I just think is very neat.
Well, and what's also neat is the sweat one. I figured they would have some sort of like a moisturometer just to detect moisture. But it's called galvanic skin resistance, or GSR.
Or electrodermal activity.
That's right. And they hook up these finger plates to galvanometers, and they are basically measuring the skin's ability to conduct electricity. Mm-hmm. And if your skin is moist, it's going to be able to conduct electricity easier.
Yes.
And that's what they're measuring there.
It's like the ones, the little heart rate monitors that they clip to your fingertips in the hospital. But these things measure electricity instead.
Yes.
Which, if you are dry, you're going to conduct less electricity.
Yeah.
If you're wet, you're going to conduct more. So since you have so many pores on the end of your fingers and you sweat when you're nervous, there you go.
Done.
So you put all this together, and it paints this picture. It's the ACLU, among other people, have decried as just, what are you doing here? Basically is what the ACLU says, right? What you have is a picture of a person who is undergoing stress,
mm-hmm.
maybe feeling embarrassment, is maybe just scared to be there, maybe doesn't like having things wrapped around his or her chest.
Yeah.
Maybe doesn't really like the person asking the questions.
Yeah.
The results of these changes in pattern, the data, is totally subjective.
That's right.
Which makes polygraphs totally subjective, which takes it in large part out of the realm of science.
Yeah, voodoo science is what they call it. And although proponents will say that a well-trained forensic psychophysiologist, which is the examiner, can get through all that to still get a good result.
Yes.
They're like, yeah, they know all this stuff. And if you're good, then you can factor that in and still get a good result.
So let's talk about what the forensic psychophysiologist does. There's apparently, I've seen anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 of them in the U.S. at any given time.
Yeah.
And some of them belong to professional organizations. I think probably maybe half or a third, depending on where you are on that estimate.
Right.
Belong to any number of professional organizations. Some have no accreditation whatsoever, but are still able to open up shops depending on the state they're in. Some states have zero laws about being a forensic psychophysiologist, aka a polygraph examiner.
That's right.
But there is also some, there are programs out there. Who wrote this article? Kevin Bonser?
I don't know.
I think so. He interviewed a guy who founded the Exiton Academy. Exiton is a manufacturer of polygraphs.
Right.
And they founded this academy as well, where you go through a certain amount of training to become a forensic psychophysiologist.
And he actually interviewed that guy?
Yeah. His name's Bob Lee.
That's Lee?
Lee. And Lee says that if you come to their academy, you have to have a baccalaureate degree, a bachelor's, right? Or you have to have at least 5 years investigative experience and an associate's degree. You have to take a 10-week course. And after you complete the 10-week course, you have to carry out 25 polygraph examinations and submit them to be reviewed. So these are like real-life ones. I guess you're working with your local police department or whatever. Maybe you're already a cop. And you have to submit it to the Accident Academy board for review. And then once they're all reviewed and everybody's all thumbs up, you are a licensed, I guess. But you're not licensed because there's no licensing body.
Yeah.
You graduate, I guess is what they call it.
Right.
So that's as accredited as it gets, I guess. And like you said, proponents of polygraph testing say that they're, if you're a good FP,
right,
you're going to be able to structure everything correctly so that you can see past somebody who sweats a lot like you,
sure,
or who gets stressed out easily like me, and design your questions appropriately, and you're going to be able to figure out whether this person is deceptive or not.
Yeah.
So how would you do that, Chuck?
Well, we should talk about the test itself, I guess. You're gonna go in and you're gonna get a pretest before you get strapped up to anything.
Right.
Could take about an hour. This is just you, and those are the only two people in the room. You're not surrounded by folks like in the movies and stuff.
Yeah.
Although in the movie sometimes it's just two people, I guess. But the pretest, you're just gonna get an interview basically about why you're being investigated. They're also gonna be profiling you and checking you out and just seeing what kind of questions you respond to and what might make you nervous, just so they'll be better informed about how to properly question you once you're all strapped in.
Right, and the pretest, when you're just kind of hanging out with them casually, the examiner is also kind of getting info out of you that you might not be aware of. Like, if you are, if you talk leisurely about your favorite beer at one point and how you like it a lot, and then later on, it also comes up that you have to drive a lot. They might use that for a control question, which could be something like, have you ever driven under the influence of alcohol? And a control question is something where you would have to admit guilt, and you may not want to, but it's such a broad question that just about anybody is guilty of it. Like, have you ever lied to somebody? Have you ever, stolen anything? That kind of thing. So where if you say no, they now have a baseline for what it looks like when you lie, that they can make a reasonable assumption that you have just lied, and any of the data captured on the polygraph, they're going to use to analyze everything else off of.
And that's pretty much it. That's the test. And afterward, you have the post-test where they look at all the data and chart out whether or not they think you're deceptive and where. Like on this question, you were deceptive. On this question, you may have been deceptive. It's kind of hard to tell. On this one, you definitely were deceptive. So,
and it's all in relation to that control question, that baseline, right?
Yeah.
So, if on questions where, I mean, they're going to have to talk to the police as well, too, and say, what do you want to know out of this person? So they'll design questions around that as well. So they may have a question like, are you wearing a blue shirt? That may be question one. It's irrelevant, right?
Right.
Question two is, have you ever lied to your boss? That's the control question. And then question three is something like, you know, did you steal the cookie from the cookie jar? Like, that's the one that the cops want them to ask.
Right.
They'll compare the results of Q3 against Q2. And if they're the same or you can't really tell, that's an inconclusive test.
Right.
So that's it. I mean, like you said, that's polygraph.
Pretty easy.
It is. It's jarringly easy considering that it's used in legal cases a lot, right?
Yes, that's true. People try to battle the lie detector in various ways. There are little tricks that the internet says works, like taking a sedative or putting antiperspirant on your fingers, which it seems like they would make you wash your hands. Putting a tack in your shoe,
mm-hmm.
And anytime you get asked a question, every single time you stomp on the tack, and the idea is that you're just going to skew the test so they all look the same.
Yeah.
So your body has the same reaction no matter what's going on.
Like if you press on the tack, your physiological response could overwhelm any response to the question, right?
Exactly.
Like I said, these things are used in legal cases, but with caveats, right? If you undergo a polygraph, whether you fail or pass, it doesn't really matter, legally speaking.
Right.
Unless you're in New Mexico.
Yeah, this is the only state that allows it.
Just openly. Like if you take a polygraph, like it's admissible in court.
Yeah.
Every other state, usually both sides have to agree on it being admitted, or the judge has to say, yeah, we're going to admit this one, right?
Yeah, and federally, the judge decides whether or not they're going to admit it.
Right, and I guess state judges kind of follow that federal ruling of polygraphing.
Yeah, and it's sort of a crapshoot if a federal judge is going to allow it or not. There's no precedent, really, to where they say we have to or we don't have to.
Right. So what are the problems with this? The problems with a polygraph or that it's subjective, right? That's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
But also because they're because it's subjective, you can get what are called false positives and false negatives.
Yeah, and you don't want that because then the test itself is just not valid.
Right. But I mean, a lot of people use that as evidence that polygraphy
shouldn't be done at all.
That it's not valid.
Yeah.
False positive in polygraphing is when you find somebody who is deemed deceptive but was telling the truth. False negative is when somebody who wasn't telling the truth is deemed truthful.
Right.
Like Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer.
Mm-hmm.
They had him for a little while and gave him a polygraph, and he passed, and they let him go, and he went and killed a bunch more women. All right?
That's right. I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah.
Well, good for him. there's also the, you know, the federal government is the largest consumer of these exams. And if you work for the federal government, you've probably had one to get the job. But you can't do that in the private sector thanks to the Polygraph Protection Act, Employee Polygraph Protection Act in the late 80s. They said you can't force your employees to do this. You can request it. But if they don't want to do it, you can't fire them because of it. You just can't do it.
Right.
Not in private land.
Right. Unless you have a contract with the government, and then that's not valid.
Right.
But yeah, the federal government is the largest opponent to them in court, but also the largest consumer.
Imagine that.
And there's been a lot of cases that shaped its admissibility or not, but the polygraph, it seems like it's kind of on its way out. I wrote an article about MRI being used as lie detectors.
Oh, really?
And that's starting to kind of come into fashion the more we start to understand like how lies are born in the brain.
Yeah.
Being able to see it and saying, this is the pattern that will happen if this person's lying, and then that pattern happens, they say, well, we know you're lying. We just saw that lie form in your brain.
That makes sense.
Yes, but at the same time, people who understand MRIs say it is way too early to be doing that, and even if we can do it with 100% accuracy, there are a lot of moral and ethical questions to it as well that
right.
we need to address first.
Always.
And then penile plethysmography.
What's that?
So remember the pneumographs that go around the chest and the abdomen?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine one of those that goes around the penis, and it does the same thing. It detects changes in contraction at girth. That's a perfect way to put it.
Yeah, wow.
And it's used to detect arousal. They use it for sex offenders. It's under at least as much attack as regular polygraphs. But there, I wrote this blog post called Using Science to Root Out Latent Homosexuality Among Homophobes.
Yeah.
A study at UGA used penile plethysmography to find if anyone who they had deemed homophobic became aroused when exposed to homosexual pornography.
Wow.
Yeah, it's one of the better posts I've ever written.
Jeez.
I think.
All right, that's our future, I guess.
Penile plethysmography for everyone.
Maybe.
For
everyone with a penis, at least.
And then, Chuck, lastly, I want to encourage everybody, if this has piqued your interest about lie detectors,
mm-hmm.
to go watch the Shoe Court Shoe Store job interview clip from Mr. Show on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
That was very good. With our friend Paul F. Tompkins in it. He has a breakthrough.
Oh, was he in that one?
Yeah.
Good old PFT.
Yep. And that's it for lie detectors, right?
Yeah, I want to take a test. If there's someone in the Atlanta area that administers these and would be willing to give me a lie detector test, I would love to do that.
Okay. And I'll watch.
Yes.
As
long as I can, you know, approve the questions.
Yes.
Or not approve them, but I don't want to be, like, rooted out as some miscreant.
It's a little late for that, Chuck.
Just keep it above board.
If you want to know more about lie detectors and play with some lie detector flash animation, you can do that by typing in lie detector on the in the search bar on howstuffworks.com. And that means it's time for listener mail.
That's right, Josh. This is from Brad. And Brad, if you remember, we had a list of suggestions from a listener not too long ago that thought our podcast could be a lot better if we changed a few things. Brad has some suggestions of his own of how we can make the podcast better. We should both have nicknames.
We do.
Zazz up the actual name, like, welcome to Stuff You Should Know with JC and the Dingo. Sit back while getting a big helping of knowledge from Chucko and the Duck. I second the suggestion to remove the personal anecdotes. Should be moved to a separate podcast called The Josh and Chuck Memoirs. Daily one-hour podcast can recount your lives from birth to present, focusing on depressing stories that are marginally factual.
It's in development.
Yes. Chuck, please raise your voice one octave. Josh, lower yours one octave.
What?
Okay, so now this is how I talk?
I talk like this.
The opening of the podcast should be a description of what each of you ate that day and the number of trips to the bathroom.
Seven.
This allows the listener to keep track at home. Hedgehogs, brain surgeons, arcades, and Bolivian politics are underrepresented on your podcast. At least 20% should be about these subjects. Do not exclude listener mail. Instead, create a quieter audio track reading the listener mail and overlay it on the rest of the podcast. That way, listeners can hear both the mail and the main content at the same time.
That's a pretty good idea.
Why not set the podcast?
We would literally drive people insane if we did that.
Why not set the podcast to a backdrop of tribal drums and jungle animal noises? It would give it an exotic feel.
That's over the listener mail track?
Over the whole thing.
So that'd be three tracks deep.
Yes. And it would lead to suspense for the listener to wonder if you'll be eaten by jaguars. And it was clear from the podcast on mummies, neither of you had ever been mummified. Please refrain from explaining topics that you don't have personal experience with. And then the final suggestion, just retell episodes of This American Life.
That last one went down like the Dave Letterman top 10 list.
So that's Brad.
Thanks, Brad. Those are all great ideas.
Tongue in
cheek.
I like
three tracks all in one, streaming at once together.
Listener mail quietly, the podcast, and tribal drumming.
Yes, and jungle noises.
Yes.
Let's see. If you have access to a polygraph and want to hook Chuck up to it, let us know.
Yeah.
You can let us know on Facebook at facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. And you can send us a regular old email at stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join How Stuff Works staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?